this is London. This is London.
The Voice of Russia World Service.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
This is the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland, with a relay transmission via Bonaire in the Netherlands Antilles, directed from New Zealand.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
Bonjour à vous si vous nous rejoignez sur Radio France Internationale. Il est 5h à Paris.
This is Radio Ukraine International.
This is the English program of Radio Deutsche Welle, Germany's international broadcasting service.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Keith Perron.
It's amazing how journalism has changed dramatically in the last 50 years. More so in the last 18 years. With the advent of things such as Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media platforms, we have been seeing an emergence of what's being known as citizen journalism. Gone are the days when the large news organizations had a monopoly over news. But this has led to certain issues that keep coming up time and time again. Some of the issues include, well, are the stories being properly researched? Is there any type of bias involved? And are sources being vetted? Now, in the last 2 years, there's been a lot of talk about something called fake news. Now, fake news is something actually that isn't exactly new. I mean, this has actually been around for a very long time. But with citizen journalism, we're seeing a lot more of it. In the way that facts are being distorted and being changed. And sometimes facts are being changed to suit the purpose of the individual who is putting the story together. Michael Burke takes a look at citizen journalism in this documentary entitled Democracy or Chaos.
In little more than a decade, information technology has changed the way we see our world, and maybe changing the world itself. The connected computer has given anybody with access to it not only his own soapbox, but his own newspaper, radio station, television channel. A new language goes with the new technology. The internet nerds have become bloggers and tweeters, and much more grandly, citizen journalists. I'm Michael Burke, reporting for the BBC World Service, and asking if citizen journalism will make the future better than the past, if it's democracy or anarchy. In the developed world, the argument is over how the internet is changing people's social lives and how it's killing traditional newspapers and broadcasting stations. But in countries run by totalitarian regimes, it promises more, nothing less than the end of tyranny. Take Myanmar, Burma, where even going online is considered a dissident act.
We've got, you know, like Gmail, we've got Gtalk, we've got mobile phones, satellite phones, and so it's very, very difficult for authoritarian regimes, particularly like the regime such as what we have in Burma, to really keep a lid on.
That Burmese blogger is one of only 40,000 people in the country who can get onto the internet. Most use cyber cafes in Rangoon, themselves closely watched by the authorities. Even so, this is how they can now reach out to the rest of the world, as Peter Marshall reported for the BBC during pro-democracy demonstrations in 2007.
While the protesters' fear is made plain in their texts and emails to the BBC, the fact they've sent them also shows their defiance.
Every word I am typing now makes me more afraid. Afraid the forces are watching me. The forces are everywhere, even in cyberspace.
How many barrels of blood do we need to show the world our hunger for democracy?
Please help my country, my Myanmar, people and monks. They are innocent. We are innocent. We just want our freedom and our human rights. This military government will never give up their power.
It's only a few people, a minority of those educated, relatively well-off and mostly English-speaking, who risk breaking the wall of silence that surrounds Myanmar. This is citizen journalism at its most dangerous and its most vital. When Cyclone Nargis struck last year, the government tried to stop the full extent of the death and destruction becoming known.
but it couldn't stop these new citizen journalists contacting the BBC. The head of its Burmese section, Tin Hassar Sway, remembers one in particular.
We asked him, how many dead bodies did you see? And he said, hundreds. And of course, everybody was very nervous to quote because there's no way we could verify the story. But we did put it out, and it turned out to be true. In the end, they admitted over 100,000 people were killed.
He was taking a huge risk. The comedian Zargana criticised the handling of humanitarian aid after the cyclone and was sentenced to 35 years jail under the so-called Electronics Act. 14 journalists and 2 bloggers are also currently in jail as the regime tries to choke off this source of news. Tin Hassar Sway again.
It is absolutely important. As you know, Burma is a closed society and we are not allowed to have a reporter inside the country. The government is clamping down on anyone who carries a camera, somebody with a microphone or recorder. They would be immediately arrested. It's one of the few methods or few access we can have to the information. What is happening inside the country is through the people who are very brave people who are willing to pass the information to us.
But how much of a risk are they realistically running?
It is difficult to tell, but there have been occasions that people have been arrested or people have been gone into hiding and people have just disappeared.
Sri Lanka is a country with a supposedly free press, but I've seen in over 20 years going there how in the long civil war between Tamil separatists in the north and the mainly Sinhalese government, truth was one of the first casualties. The war, now at last over, so polarised the communities that neutrality, objectivity, seemed unacceptable to both sides. The result, self-censorship, strident partiality, and little trustworthy reporting or judicious commentary. To some extent, the internet filled a vacuum. Websites like Ground Views, for instance. Its editor, Sanjana Hatatatua, on how traditional journalism was suppressed.
The consequences of such reporting have been physical harm, abduction, assassination, and many journalists going out of Sri Lanka, being forced out of Sri Lanka into self-exile. In the country, Tamil journalists have borne the brunt of the attacks and the violence against independent media. And what is of enduring concern, even after the end of the war, is that not a single one of the investigations into these killings, abductions and violence against independent media shows any signs of meaningful progress.
The government itself is having nothing of this. Professor Ranjiva Wijasinghe is the Human Rights Ministry Secretary. Journalists, new and old, are free and respected, he says.
We didn't allow people into the place where fighting was taking place for the obvious reason that they would be endangered. I think one of the most lunatic things we had was, I think,
Professor, it's a slightly disingenuous point, isn't it? It has a slightly self-interested and disingenuous ring to it.
Well, you know that, you know, parents have to look after children, and children, as they're growing up, as you and I probably did, resented this. But
is that how you characterise the relationship between government and media, parents
and
children?
No, I characterise that as a relationship between anyone who is responsible and accountable and people who aren't.
The proponents of citizen journalism would say that citizen journalism is a kind of threat to oppressive governments because it can't be controlled and threatened in the kind of way that more traditional forms of the media, a newspaper, can be threatened.
I think what you're implying is that the Sri Lankan government's been intimidating journalists. And I think if you look at the Sri Lankan papers now, there can be no question of intimidation. I find the citizen journalists, perhaps because they are so, let's say, aggressively individualistic, less, arrogant in the belief that they will actually influence events.
The conflict between regime and internet in Iran is neither shadowy nor subtle. It's out on the streets in the wake of a disputed presidential election. Iran has the Middle East's most militant bloggers and the government that's most determined to bring them under control. 5 million websites have already been blocked. But it's the citizen journalists who are telling the world what's happening on the streets, as the BBC's Sarah Rainsford reported.
6 days after Iran's disputed election, another vast crowd marched through the capital. Many people came out in black to mourn those killed in previous protests. The foreign press is now banned from these rallies. but defiant demonstrators are filming themselves and sending us the video. It was close to midnight on Tuesday on Gandhi Street in Tehran. It's at night that pro-government militiamen are on the street. In this video footage we received, demonstrators flee the Basij militia. One protester falls to the ground. He's surrounded and beaten with batons. Later, the crowd returns carrying a body. They shout, "I'll kill those who killed my brother."
Mona Eltaway is an award-winning columnist who writes for some of the most important traditional news media in the West. She was born in the Middle East and describes herself as a proud liberal Muslim. She watched all this from New York and thinks something really significant is happening.
I heard a young Iranian woman say that this is the first time in her country's history where Iranians themselves were able to set the agenda, say what was happening, shoot the footage and show the world the picture of themselves they wanted the world to see. And that's really powerful.
So what could you see and read about the unfolding events in Iran that you weren't seeing on mainstream media?
You could see Iranians say, "I love my country. This is not about me overthrowing the regime, but I'm going to go out there because this is about the future of my country." This was all important that we were reading and seeing all of this because the Iranian regime barred media from going out on the streets, especially foreign media, and reporting all these things to us. So if the journalists, the mainstream journalists, couldn't get out on the street and ask that young man and woman, "Why are you here demonstrating and endangering your life?" That young man and woman could go on Twitter and say, "I've had enough of this. I deserve a say. This is unjust and I will not stand for it."
For Mona Eltaway, citizen journalism is important not just because it does what old-style journalists can't do, but what they won't do. Perspective as well as access. In Iraq, for instance, she says it was Iraqi bloggers who told the world what it was like to be on the receiving end.
It was citizen journalists who were dismayed by the way the invasion of Iraq was portrayed in the mainstream media, especially in the West, especially in the United States. And so they went online and launched blogs. And the most famous of them were one by an Iraqi man called Salam Pax and another one by a young Iraqi woman who used the name Riverbend and another one by an Iraqi man called Ra'id Jarrar. And the three of them would use their blogs as a kind of daily journal to tell mostly Americans, but the whole world, what it's like to be Iraqis on the receiving end of this so-called shock and awe of the American invasion and of the war in Iraq. And so they became this voice that we did not hear. I mean, I, as an Egyptian living in the United States, was dismayed that I never saw Iraqis on US television networks. I saw them online in their blogs.
That's all very well, but by its very nature, the blogging is mostly partial, subjective, and unaccountable. It's a vehicle for the politics of dissent. And, by the way, it doesn't seem to have changed anything.
It's absolutely the politics of dissent. And I think just by its very nature of giving a voice to the voiceless, because the trouble with the Middle East, as in many other parts of the world, is that we get a very unipolar image of what's happening or just one or two images. You know, it's either we're talking about terrorists blowing themselves up or we're talking about the Israeli-Arab conflict. But there are so many other aspects to the Middle East that we don't see, especially that concerning young people. More than 60% of people in the Middle East are younger than 30. So you're talking about an amazing force that has its own ambitions, that has its own dreams that we rarely hear about. So here are young people who want to tell us that we have other dreams and ambitions besides those two prisms, and it's time that we told you about them.
You talk about the powerful nature of it, the new politics of dissent, but actually nothing has been achieved, has it?
Perhaps not politically. We're not seeing, you know, bloggers haven't overthrown a regime, for example. And I think this is what people are waiting to happen. What bloggers are doing is spreading the word, expressing themselves in a part of the world where the mere fact of expressing yourself can be illegal and get you into trouble.
Even on that basis, there are problems with citizen journalism. Obvious problems of truth and trust, of trying to separate fact from mere opinion. Trying to work out how far you can rely on people you don't know, saying things you cannot check. Rosalind Coward is Professor of Journalism at Roehampton University in London.
There's a kind of fetish of authenticity. There are some problems in it, which are, first of all, it's open to fakery and inauthenticity, strangely enough, that there are very few checks on these so-called kind of authentic voices, that actually in a way it's the most open to fantasists, exhibitionists, people who want to put themselves forward for various reasons, people who want to get in on a drama. It's actually open to all sorts of abuse and fakery. And also, it isn't necessarily the case that the ordinary voice is better than the organisational voice. There's no guarantee that the kind of voices that are kind of talking to each other, that they are actually authentic. A lot of them, things can be planted there. I think the lack of accountability is possibly one of the most problematic elements of citizen journalism, in that you are accountable to no one, and therefore you can put forward any opinion and dress it up as observation or accurate fact. I think there is a real danger that people will lose the kind of habits of what we understand as democracy, i.e. that things have to be put through scrutiny, debate, voting, they have to be in the public sphere, they have to be examined.
Professor Rosalind Coward. Sanjana Hattatatua, editor of the Ground Views website in Sri Lanka, remember, doesn't accept any of those arguments, and anyway says it's too late. The genie, he told BBC World Service, is out of the bottle.
Is it the answer to clamp down on only authorised sources of information? Who then defines what is authorised and what is an authentic, objective narrative? And what then do you do with inconvenient truths? Or is it the case that, in what I feel is a functioning democracy, you risk the multiplicity of voices and you strengthen media literacy so that an informed citizenry will, at the end of the day, make the decision as to what media they believe? There was a press conference where five doctors who, at the peak of war, were communicating information of ground casualties to international and local media, recanted and said that they only did so under pressure from the LTTE, and many of those numbers were false. So what do you do now? Do you say that they shouldn't have published those doctors, the information that they provided from the ground, which at the time was the only information coming out? Or should you have done it in a qualified manner, which is what I would suggest and recommend and have always done on Ground Views, suggesting that this is not the whole truth, but that this is a facet and that this should be and can be contested, and that its contestation, and through its contestation, lies perhaps the capital T truth.
Sanjana Hattatatua. Glenn Reynolds is the man they call the king of the bloggers. He's a law professor in Tennessee and has a weblog called Instapundit, one of the most widely read political blogs in America. He says you have to be careful in the new information world, but then you had to in the old one.
With big organizations, you get what Hannah Arendt called the bureaucratic diffusion of responsibility. And for example, Walter Duranty, who covered up Stalin's starvation of the kulaks in the Ukraine, won a Pulitzer Prize for it. And the New York Times, I think, still has his name on a plaque in their office building, even though his complicity in that mass murder is now fairly well established. I don't think any blogger's done anything quite that bad. In all cases, you have to know who you can trust, and you have to evaluate them not based on their credentials, but on what they do and on whether what they say comports with other stuff you know.
Professor Reynolds thinks technology has ushered in the era of everyman. Where once journalism was the preserve of rich and powerful news organizations, often with rich and powerful owners.
The big trend that's going on in this century technologically, and it's not all about journalism by any means, is that technologies are lowering the minimum efficient scale for doing things. So that things that used to could be done only by large organizations with a lot of staff can now be done by individuals or small groups. Now, there's a downside to that, of course. I mean, terrorism is an example of that phenomenon as well. You can make war with a relatively small number of close friends and some high explosives. But it is also the case that things like news gathering, production of music, production of television and video and movies and such, that used to require multi-million dollar budgets can now be done very well on the cheap.
In what way does citizen journalism empower the little guy as opposed to merely allowing the little guy to show off?
Well, I think for one thing, it makes it harder to jerk them around. And one excellent example of this is the District of Columbia's police chief complained about people using an Apple iPhone app to spot the red light cameras and speed traps that they have scattered around the District of Columbia. D.C. doesn't like that because they've raised $1 billion in traffic fines with these sorts of things. And they're quite offended that people are sort of banding together to spot them and cut its opportunity to fleece the public.
It all sounds good fun, but it doesn't sound like Watergate, does it?
Well, no, and, you know, that's sort of one of the big complaints about citizen journalism is that you don't see the kind of sustained investigative journalism and digging that you see from big media. And to a point, that's a fair critique. What makes it a less fair critique is the fact that you don't see that kind of journalism that much from big media anymore either.
Professor Glenn Reynolds. Dan Gilmore is the great proselytizer for the new journalism of the Internet. The author of a book called We the Media, he's scathing about the failures of the old journalism and excited about the way the new media can engage and capitalize on its audience.
There was a wholesale mass failure of the journalists to do their jobs. The run-up to the Iraq War was a classic market failure of journalism in the United States because it was catastrophic. Their failure to cover what was going on and to be honest was catastrophic for journalism and, I believe, for this nation. I think a lot of people's trust level has crumbled somewhat. Now, the new technologies, the new ability to create media mean that we're seeing people in every topic you can think of, there's at least somebody who is picking a very narrow niche with a very limited audience, but a passionate one, and going incredibly deep. Journalism is, and news is, becoming a conversation as opposed to the lecture mode of the past. And that's only good. It means that the people who I've been calling the former audience, they can and increasingly are having conversations with the journalists, which is wonderful for the journalists if they're just willing to listen and to recognize that their audience, no matter what it is they cover, the audience knows a lot more than the journalist could ever know.
That might be true as a generality, but that's not true of individuals, is it? I mean, is it always so fascinating what an uninformed member of the public thinks about a complex issue of the day?
No matter how expert one is in anything, the audience for that knows more collectively. By definition, the people who care about a topic collectively have to know more than any one person.
Dan Gilmore. Viewed from California, the question is whether the Internet and its citizen journalists is an interesting new direction for democracy, or a way of pooling the shallow preoccupations of anybody with access to a computer. Mona Eltaway, looking east from New York, sees it differently.
What most excites me about the legacy of the online revolution is that it has allowed young people, young men and women, to say, I have a say and I deserve to be heard. And as simple as that sounds, in a region that has been ruled by dictators and royal families who just basically pass on the rule and whose sons inherit their titles and presidencies, that's incredibly powerful. Because what those regimes have been doing for decades now is basically telling people, you don't count. We won't have elections, and even if we do have elections, your votes are nothing. But what you're seeing online now is young men and women saying, no, I do count. What's interesting to see is this cat and mouse game, you know, is never ending, because every time the regimes try to either clamp down or shut down, for example, blogs, those young people outwit them and are two or three steps ahead of them and using technology to their advantage.
Nowhere is that cat-and-mouse game being played out with more fervour than in Egypt. This is Wael Abbas, pioneer blogger there, on what he and his fellow Egyptian citizen journalists are trying to achieve.
I want the Egyptians to have awareness. They have to have the knowledge, to have the ability to choose and to decide which is right and which is wrong. That's why I called my blog the Egyptian Awareness.
Citizen Journalism, Democracy or Chaos, was produced and presented by Michael Burke. And we will bring you another part of that documentary very soon. If you wish to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the documentaries that we have been presenting right here on Media Network Plus, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. Once again, mnp@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Parent, wishing you all, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. 73 and 88 to the ladies.
Fly on one wing. Neither a plane can manage with one engine.
This is Olympia Radio. Call us on channel. This is Olympia Radio. Call us on channel. This is Olympia Radio. Call us on channel. This is Olympia Radio. Call us on channel.
As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing. As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing. As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing. Neither a plane can manage with one engine.
This is Olympia Radio. Call us on channel. This is Olympia Radio. Call us on channel. This is Olympia Radio. Call us on channel. This is Olympia Radio. Call us on channel.
As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing. As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing. As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing. Neither a plane can manage with one engine.
This is Olympia Radio. Call us on channel. 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 Channels. This is Olympia Radio. Call us on channels.